2 Samuel chapter 19, we're going to read from verse 40, and then we're going to read through most of chapter 20. See, and then I'll do a brief recap. Again, I don't know if you're anything like me, but I forget very quickly what's gone before, especially as we're going through this 2 Samuel. It's not all bits that we might know very well. So I'm just going to do a really quick, brief recap after we've read this as well. Now the king went on to Gilgal, and Chimham went on with him. And all the people of Judah escorted the king, and also half the people of Israel. Just then, all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, "Why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen you away, and brought the king, his household, and all David's men with him across the Jordan?" So all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, "Because the king is a close relative of ours. Why then are you angry over this matter? Have we ever eaten at the king's expense, or has he given us any gift?" And the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, "We have 10 shares in the king. Therefore we also have more right to David than you. Why then do you despise us? Were we not the first to advise bringing back our king? Yet the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel." And there happened to be there a rebel whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. And he blew a trumpet and said, "We have no share in David, nor do we have inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel." So every man of Israel deserted David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. But the men of Judah, from the Jordan as far as Jerusalem, remained loyal to their king. Now David came to his house at Jerusalem, and the king took the 10 women, his concubines, whom he had left to keep the house, and put them in seclusion and supported them, but did not go into them. So they were shut up to the day of their death, living in widowhood. And the king said to Amasa, "Assemble the men of Judah for me within 3 days, and be present here yourself." So Amasa went to assemble the men of Judah, but he delayed longer than the set time which David had appointed him. And David said to Abishai, "Now Sheba, the son of Bichri, will do us more harm than Absalom. Take your lord's servants and pursue him, lest he find for himself 45 cities and escape us." So Joab's men, with the Cherethites, the Pelethites, and all the mighty men, went out after him. And they went out of Jerusalem to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. When they were at the large stone, which is in Gibeon, Amasa came before them. Now Joab was dressed in battle armour. On it was a belt with a sword fastened in its sheath at his hips. And as he was going forward, it fell out. Then Joab said to Amasa, "Are you in health, my brother?" And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. But Amasa did not notice the sword that was in Joab's hand, and he struck him with it in the stomach, and his entrails poured out on the ground. And he did not strike him again, thus he died. Then Joab and Abishai his brother pursued Sheba the son of Bichri. Meanwhile one of Joab's men stood near Amasa and said, "Whoever favours Joab and whoever is for David, follow Joab." But Amasa wallowed in his blood in the middle of the highway. And when the man saw that all the people stood still, he moved Amasa from the highway to the field and threw a garment over him, when he saw that everyone who came upon him halted. When he was removed from the highway, all the people went on after Joab to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. And he went through all the tribes of Israel to Abel and Beth Machah and all the Berites. So they were gathered together and also went after Sheba. Then they came and besieged him in Abel of Beth Machah, and they cast up a siege mound against the city, and it stood by the rampart. And all the people who were with Joab battered the wall to throw it down. Then a wise woman cried out from the city, "Hear, hear, please say to Joab, come nearby, that I may speak with you." When he had come near to her, the woman said, "Are you Joab?" He answered, "I am." Then she said to him, "Hear the words of your maidservant." And he answered, "I am listening." So she spoke, saying, "They used to talk in former times, saying, they shall surely seek guidance at Abel, and so they would end disputes. I am among the peaceable and faithful in Israel. You seek to destroy a city and a mother in Israel. Why would you swallow up the inheritance of the Lord? And Joab answered and said, Far be it from me that I should swallow up or destroy. That is not so. But a man from the mountains of Ephraim, Sheba, the son of Bichri by name, has raised his hand against the king, against David. Deliver him only, and I will depart from the city. So the woman said to Joab, Watch, his head will be thrown to you over the wall. Then the woman, in her wisdom, went to all the people, and they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it out to Joab. Then he blew a trumpet, and they withdrew from the city, every man to his tent. So Joab returned to the king at Jerusalem. A little bit gory in bits. I found it quite hard going through this passage. You might not be surprised to learn. So we'll see how we go. I'll try and draw out some application points from that as we go. And hopefully it'll be a benefit to us. So a quick recap. David is king. It sounds funny saying that as a recap point, but we've been over a lot of ground before David became king as well in these studies. So David became king. Then we were introduced to Absalom, David's son, and we saw his rebellion against both his father and his king. He committed murder. We saw that David's inaction with his sons to deal with that sin actually compounded problems. We saw Absalom trying to take David's throne by force, by sin. We've seen David running and hiding and then ultimately getting in battle with Absalom's army. And then two studies ago, Steve took us through Absalom's death with his hair being caught in the tree. And Joab's violence started to come out in that part of the story as well. We'll see a bit more of Joab's violent nature tonight. And then last week, Peter took us through David crossing the River Jordan on his way back to Jerusalem and him placing, in the last chapter, Amasa in charge of his army instead of Joab. And that's quite important that that happened, because that sort of comes up tonight, that David chose to put Amasa in charge of his army instead of the violent Joab. So, I just wanted to give you a little bit of a feel for where all of this is going on. So some of you might know, this sounds rich coming from me, you might know a bit of geography from the person who knows nothing and didn't do very well. So where it says Sinai, in the middle there, that's Egypt as we know it now, yeah? So Sharm el-Sheikh, famous or common holiday destination, is at the bottom of that little peak. Then you've got the Red Sea that Red Sea goes up that side, the Gulf of Aqabah, I think it is, goes up that side. Then you've got these two bits of water just up where on the left of Jordan on the line going up. That is the River Jordan, and you've got the Sea of Galilee at the top and the Dead Sea in the middle. So that's the sort of more modern day. What? So that gives you a feel for the geography of where this is all occurring in kind of modern day terms. Then you would have seen, heard a reference as we were just going through to Israel and Judah, and about them fighting over David to start with. So Judah being the southern part, so here's the Salt Sea or the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee again. So this is a blow up, zooming in, of the previous one. So you see Judah in the south and Israel in the north, and there's a map in a minute that will show you the 12 tribes and where they were located. And about how, did you notice in the verse we read about, we have more parts of David? That was talking about the tribes. So, last time, Pete took you through David hiding in Mahanaim, and then this is the River Jordan. So, we've started tonight with him coming from Mahanaim across the River Jordan, and you heard that Gibeon being mentioned in the reading. And that's on the way back down south, so he's come west and south towards Jerusalem. Ignore the faith images thing. Copy-paste internet. And then this is the 12 tribes, which I found quite interesting to see. Manasseh did quite well, two big bits up there in the middle. So when you hear about the northern tribes and the southern tribes, if you drew a line, I need a little thingamabob. If you drew a line where you see Judah and Simeon, if you drew a line across the top of the Dead Sea there, that's the southern, just Judah and Simeon. Everything else, although Reuben is technically beneath that line, everything else is classed as northern tribes. Everyone with me?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to leave that one up whilst we carry on. So, we might flick back and forth over a few of them. But I thought it might be useful to you to understand where they're going and what's going on. It helps me. So, tonight then, we arrive at the back end of chapter 19 and chapter 20, and we see that David is basically never far from trouble or strife. There's always something going on, isn't there, in these passages. Modern day speak, you might say, he never catches a break. But we'll see then, as well as we go through, that this is because sin and Satan is always near. And we'll see that despite human failure and error and sin, God still preserves David and the line that Jesus would ultimately come from. So just briefly, to finish chapter 19, before we go on to the main part of the study tonight, which is chapter 20. In verse 40 then, we catch up with David on his travels west, from the River Jordan through Gilgal and then on to Jerusalem. And you see in the verses that we read that the people are starting to unite. It says, all the people of Judah escorted the king and half the people of Israel. They're coming together. They're starting to unite. They've got their king. They're walking him back to Jerusalem. The 10 northern tribes and the 2 southern tribes are escorting David. How long does it last? Not very long at all. I did have a little chuckle to myself when I read this, because it made me think about the fact that the north versus south debate was actually millennia old. When we go to camp, there's a common north versus south thing. Just made me chuckle when I read the northerners and the southerners not getting on. So it doesn't last very long. The people aren't getting on very well for very long. The people from Israel, the 10 northern tribes, came to David saying, why are you letting the people of Judah take you away from us? The people of Judah quickly jump in, don't they? It's like a proper little fight. Well, because he's family. And then they start arguing who makes up the largest share. Can you imagine being David at this time with people arguing over you about, I have 10 parts in him and you only have 2 parts. He's mine. And then we're left with a closing statement that says Judah argued more vehemently, basically. And then we come on to chapter 20, which is our main part. And as I say, I don't mind saying it's quite hard actually to figure out how to go through this chapter tonight. My first thought when I went through this was going to be 2.5 minutes long, because we'll read the passage and it's basically narrative. And it's quite hard to think, where do we go with this? So it is quite a straightforward narrative, but there are actually a few lessons that I think we can take out of it. And thanks to Tom for a brief catch-up I had with him about a few things on this as well. So we're introduced then in verse 1 of chapter 20 to someone called Sheba. Just for the avoidance of doubt, this is a man, not the queen. Okay. He comes from the tribe of Benjamin, which is up in the northern part. Actually, you can't see it now. Yeah, purple, right in the middle, the little one, thank you. So, he comes from the northern part. So, he's from the group that have basically just said, right in the middle. he comes from the part of the people that said, oh, well, leave David then, we have no part in him. Did you notice how quickly the Israelites said that? So, they've gone from saying, we have 10 parts in David, he's our king, we want him. One verse later, Sheba, this bloke, we have no share in David. How quickly he turns, how fickle their commitment was to their king. And civil war commences. Now, this is the first little sort of application point, if you like, that I'd like to just raise and suggest. This is our first lesson here, about being on our guard to see how committed we are, or how fickle we may have tendencies to be sometimes. And to be on our guard, not to have our heads turned as well. That we remain focused on the one that gives us life. Am I a fickle Christian? The words of Ephesians 4:14 came to my mind at this point. We should no longer be children, tossed to and fro, carried about by every wind of doctrine. The next part of the verse. Growing up in all things into him who is the head, Christ. But not only this, what made me think about these people suddenly going, I love you, David, to I hate you, David, in paraphrase, made me think how easy it is to take blessings for granted and actually to forget the giver. So this is their king. They asked for a king, they wanted a king, and they've gone from saying that they love him to saying, we don't want you. And I wonder if it made me think about how fickle perhaps sometimes we are ourselves, how fickle I can be, in terms of remembering God, forgetting God, taking God's blessings constantly, but forgetting that God is the giver. And then finally, just in this little brief point of application, notice the loyalty of the people of Judah. In spite of mocking from the other 10 parts of the 12, in spite of danger and perhaps discomfort, they're probably not all appreciating the confrontation here, but despite all of that, they were loyal to their king. I think that shows us a little picture of what we should imitate to be. That's the sort of behaviour that we should be imitating towards our king, Jesus, the one who never stopped short for us, did he? And never has stopped short for us. It just made me think about the two reactions, these two groups of people, the northerners and the southerners, to their king, and how quickly that changed, about what mindset that should maybe just make us think about, what it made me think about. So we go on to verses 4 to 7 of chapter 20 now. And in verse 4, we see that David reinforces the appointment of Amasa from the previous chapter, 19, to be leader of the army. He's commanded to gather the army. Amasa, assemble the men of Judah for me within 3 days and be present here yourself. Fairly clear direction to a military person. Go and do this. You've got 3 days, not 12 hours. Seems reasonable to go and do that. But for some reason, Amasa doesn't manage to do it, does he? Did you see then in verse 5? So Amasa went to assemble the men of Judah, but he delayed longer than the set time which David had appointed him. So he didn't manage to do it. I'm not overly clear, if I'm honest, about whether or not that's because of a lack of trying, because it says he delayed, or because 3 days wasn't long enough to actually gain a following. Bearing in mind, this is a new leader of the army. So perhaps 3 days wasn't long enough for him to actually gain the following of the people who had been so used to following someone else, Joab. So he fails. Either way, for whatever reason, David then turns to Abishai in verse 6. And he says, now Sheba, the son of Bichri, will do us more harm than Absalom. So David was clearly quite worried about what could be coming if he didn't act. So you could say David's actually learned from some inaction in the past, actually, and now he's actually putting into action a plan because he recognises the danger. Note, this is quite important, I think, note that it's not Joab again. It's actually Joab's brother, Abishai, to get the same job done that Amasa failed to do. And he basically commands that Sheba should be pursued to death because of the danger that he presented. So you see that David is really, really against putting Joab back into his position. So the men then start out on their journey to go and pursue Amasa. So we go to the next section, which is verses 8 to 14. And this is the section that is a little bit gory. Apologies for younger ones or older ones that are faint-hearted. It is a little bit gory. They cover Joab not liking the competition, basically, as a competitor to be army leader. And he pretends to greet Amasa, but sneakily stabs him, basically. So it said, now Joab was dressed in battle armour, middle of verse 8. On it was a belt with a sword fastened in its sheath at its hips. And as he was going forward, it fell out. Now, when you read different commentaries on this, it basically says that it didn't fall out. It was actually quite well engineered by Joab in such a way that he deliberately put it a bit loose so that it would come loose and look like it had fallen, and he then grabbed it and hid it. Someone else, another commentary, actually said perhaps he had a second sword and it was all deliberate, make the first one fall so that Amasa thinks that he's unarmed and can't possibly do him any danger, but actually then he's got a second one over here. Either way, the commentators are quite clear that this is a deliberate act of deceit, basically, on Joab's part to kill Amasa. Just a side note, I don't know if you noticed, that the custom at that point was greet someone by grabbing their beard. and then kiss them. I really feel like we should maybe bring back this custom. I'm telling Mark to keep growing his beard. We can have a little bit of fun with Mark. Greeting. So it's worth noting here, aside from the beard matter, that Amasa had actually been asked to replace Joab as army leader twice now in two chapters, once by Absalom and now David. Not that that excuses murder, but in Joab's mind, he's actually now, from both Absalom and David, been subsumed. He's been thrown aside, cast aside, and Amasa has been asked to take his place. So Amasa and Joab now they weren't going to be the best of friends after something like that. But is there a lesson here? I was looking at this thinking, I don't think any of us are about to start pretending swords are going to fall from a belt or anything, but is there a lesson here? Well, I think there actually is. And it's similar to a lesson that I drew out in the last study we did on David, actually. And that is that, can you see what holding a grudge can do? Can you see what seeking one-upmanship, if you understand the phrase, can do? Like I said, I'm not suggesting we're all on that particular edge, but harbouring negative feelings like Joab did is dangerous, and it will affect your spiritual life. I think there is a lesson there to be on our guard for how we're reacting, even internally, to different situations. Does it result in us harbouring feelings that we shouldn't do, and feelings that we need to deal with, perhaps, or emotions that we need to deal with? Because it's not God-honouring to harbour those. Going on from there then, you can see that Joab was quite clearly a well-respected military leader. Notwithstanding his deceit and his murder that he's just committed, you can see that after Amasa is literally out of sight because something's been thrown on him, the army just follow on straight away without hesitation. So clearly Joab had the respect as an army leader, at least as a military leader. It's also possible that the reason they were so swift to follow after Joab again is because they actually didn't warm to Amasa, thinking that he still favoured the rebel northern side of Israel instead of Judah, because that's where he came from. So it's possible that actually this north versus south again, that they actually didn't warm to him anyway. I just want to stop for 1 second on verse 14 of chapter 20. I don't know if you might have missed something first time round, or you're more intelligent than me and you got it first time round and it took me a bit longer. But do you see that Joab actually manages to find army additions, so David followers, David lovers, in some of the northern tribes? So these are the southerners going through the northern tribes trying to find Sheba. And you see in verse 14, he went through all the tribes of Israel to Abel and Beth Maacah and all the Berites. So they were gathered together and also went after Sheba. He's actually that much of a military force and captain that he's actually managed to persuade people who had originally said, oh yeah, we don't want David, I'm going to follow Sheba, to actually go, actually, what am I doing? I'm going to go back to King David. So clearly he did have an ability to lead an army. So we go on to the next section then, from verses 15 to 22. And these verses cover the army of David locating Sheba in hiding in Abel of Beth Maacah. Now, I think on that one at the top. So they've actually had to travel quite a long way. That's why I put that one up there, actually. So David's come from Mahanaim, across the River Jordan, down back to Jerusalem. This army have actually gone across the River Jordan and up a long way again, up to Abel Beth Maacah, all the way above the Sea of Galilee. I haven't chucked a little ruler on it to see how far that is, but it's about 80 miles. So it's a reasonable distance that they've just travelled to find him in Abel. It ends up getting shortened to a place called Abel. And these verses also introduce us to a wise woman, we're told, whose name we aren't given. I did try and search around to see if actually we do know her name from another passage, and I can't see that we do. So this woman is, it's funny, isn't it? I remember hearing a sermon on this before about certain people that are unnamed, so that you perhaps focus more on their act rather than their name. And I think that's what's happening here. I think we're deliberately being told this is a wise woman. Her actions were wise. So this woman, this lady, recognises that her city is just about to come under what would probably be quite a lengthy, painful siege, painful war on her doorstep that would take lots of innocent life and devastate a perfectly fine city. So she actually negotiates with Joab. Now that's even more interesting on the back of what I've just said. This Joab, this captain of an army who's clearly got so much about him and such a following that he's managed to convince the northerners who had turned from David to turn back to him. And this woman starts negotiating with him. So she's clearly very wise to take that on. And she secures, we read, I won't read all the verses again, she secures Joab's agreement that this very well-respected city, it has quite a heritage, seemingly, as being a wise city as well, with this positive heritage, that it would be left alone if she did something. And that something was that she had to deliver Sheba's head to him. And sure enough, she delivers Sheba's head to him, chucks it over the wall. So someone has actually commented that this wisdom is really akin to Abigail's. Do you remember months or years? Could be years, couldn't it now? Ago, we actually looked at the wisdom of Abigail. And both ladies prevented some serious bloodshed, basically, and some serious unnecessary fighting. Is there a lesson to learn here? There's an application here for us, I think. And my thought here is to question whether or not we are peacemakers and peacekeepers. So do I think of peace before thinking of angry thoughts? I have a bit of a temper that I have to try and deal with. Do I always think of a peace before I think of an angry thought? Probably not. Or possibly, dare I even say, revenge? Do we think of peace before revenge? Because this wise woman has, hasn't she? She could have gone on the offensive, thinking she was under siege, but instead she takes a step back, applies wisdom, and realises that actually the better part is to think of the peaceful situation. So I just wonder, are we quick, am I quick, to go on the defensive sometimes, instead of looking for a Christ-centred solution? I was reading something at the train station on the way home, which fitted in quite nicely with this, from Desiring God, from John Piper's organisation. Psalm is throwing you back to a verse in the Bible. Psalm 50, verse 15. Call upon me in the day of trouble. I will deliver you. You shall glorify me. So that verse fits in quite well with what this wise woman has done, actually, and how we can apply that to ourselves. Call upon me in the day of trouble. That would be a wise choice, wouldn't it? To call on God in the time of trouble. I will deliver you, you shall glorify, and you shall glorify me. And John Piper has actually said on this point how amazing it is then that actually you get what you need, if you like, but God gets the glory. Win-win. How amazing God's plan is. The other part of application, if you like, in here that I was thinking about is that Jesus never got angry with a wrong motive, did he? We read about righteous anger, but he never got angry with a wrong motive. And there is hatred and strife all over the world, isn't there? Sarah won't watch the news because she can't part with it. There is hatred and strife in the whole world, and we should see our role as Christians and in our church to be galvanizers, really, I think. Bringing people together out of love and not trying to push people apart. So I think there's a lesson here about what this woman has done and the wisdom that she showed for us within our church, but as a church in the world as well, about what our mindset is about being peace makers, to start with, and peace keepers. Then at the end of verse 22, we read that Joab and the army returned to Jerusalem, having fulfilled the king's orders. So I was going to skip that. I won't skip that. I will do that bit just quickly. Matthew Henry has commented on this historical event and has actually likened this to a picture of God's dealings in saving people. Let me share this with you. The unbeliever's soul is besieged with guilt and distress. So we've got a town here that's being besieged, about to be taken over. The unbeliever's soul is besieged with guilt and distress. Sin is the traitor that's hiding inside. but cast out and cast away that sin and the desire to do life our way, and peace will reign in that city that is our soul. I'll say that once more, just in case it's useful to you. The unbeliever's soul is besieged with guilt and distress, just like this town was being besieged. Sin is the traitor, just like Sheba was hiding. Sin is the traitor that hides in our soul. But cast it away, cast out that sin that's in the way, and peace will reign in that soul. So, just very briefly, by way of conclusion, I've got four recap or conclusion points to try and leave you with something. Are we truly loyal? Number one, are we truly loyal constantly to our King? Are we quick to turn away sometimes? Am I quick to forget God, particularly in good times? It's easy sometimes to remember God in bad times when you want something or need something, maybe. Am I quick to forget him, particularly in good times? So let's be reminded that our goal must surely be to always seek to be ever closer to Jesus. Conclusion point number two. See how the fight at Abel in this city nearly broke out because of a misunderstanding. Did you notice that? Joab thought the city was actually deliberately harbouring and defending this man Sheba. The people of Abel thought that Joab was just simply interested in killing anyone he could. But actually, one conversation brought clarity to that situation because of a wise act. I wonder how much bad feeling could be prevented by trying to understand others. Just a little bit of understanding. You could have had disaster there. And one wise act has prevented it. I think that's a really good point to take away. Conclusion point number three. It's interesting that someone had to choose to speak up to Joab to stop that siege. I don't know what you'd be like in that situation. You might be like me and be thinking of running the other way instead of trying to step up and show a wise act, thinking that you're about to come under war. But someone had to take that step of faith, you could say, and actually show an act of wisdom. One person had to take action. And this was a reminder to me, perhaps not just to wait and expect others to always do something. I think I sometimes have a tendency to do that. I think it's okay, someone else will probably do that, it's okay. Well, if this woman had thought like that, the wise act wouldn't have been shown and the town might have been devastated by war. So, particularly even in the church maybe, this is a call to be the wise servant of the body. To be the wise servant of our body. And it might mean stepping up sometimes to do something, rather than thinking it's okay, it will happen. Last conclusion point, number four. Finally, I've written. Is our aim to be peacemakers and peacekeepers in the church? I think this is probably the biggest point I took away from this. Are we more interested in glorifying God than anything else? Is that our aim in life and in our church? To glorify God more than anything else. Well, let's pray that God will help us to be the wise woman, for those of us that are men, to be the wise woman in all our dealings and in all of our witness in the church and outside of the church as well.